this idea that's been pushed around that people have to tighten their belts so that business can recover, it's a lot of crock, isn't it?
Work is not a thing we do because we love it, but because we have to. And the only way we can make it better is by fighting.
There's a lot of adversity happening in the world, but Black folks have always been in the midst of that. The world has always been burning.
The vast majority of the population in the United States, including the majority of workers, have never been in a union, don't know anything about unions, and what they have heard about unions is utter BS.
Then moving down to North Carolina, we're looking at the people down there doing the same job that we're doing for $6-7 less an hour. They're not union, and they don't want any union influence down there.
We have broken, or some would say rigged, immigration system that works really well for employers.
You're really lucky if you get one song out that people will sing when you're gone. I've heard Have You Been to Jail for Justice sung in Copenhagen by young kids being evicted from the youth house. I've heard it sung by a bunch of people, including Daniel Ellsberg, who were arrested in front of the White House over the Keystone Pipeline.
Right.
The song has really gotten legs, and it's doing what I want it to do.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, we welcome a new member of the network from Down Under, as Solidarity Breakfast, based in Melbourne, Australia, reports on workers at an ice cream shop fighting for their rights. On this week's Your Rights at Work radio show, labor journalist Sarah Jaffe told us why work won't love you back. Then, the On Writing podcast talks with award-winning screenwriter Lena Waithe, creator and writer on the Bet comedy series 20s. We've got a mini theme on plant closings as the Heartland Labor Forum features Mike Stout on his new book, The Homestead Steel Mill, The Final 10 Years. And on My Labor Radio, we hear about an auto supply plant that's closing down later this year in Auburn, Indiana. On this week's Labor Radio Podcast Network live stream, the topic was what a progressive pro-labor migration policy might look like. Our final segment today is a special presentation of the final edition of We Do the Work, which is ending an amazing 8-year run on KSVR-FM in Washington State's Skagit Valley. They go out with a lovely interview with Ann Feeney, one of the finest labor singers in the country, and several of her favorite songs. We're playing the entire program in tribute to a show that's been such a great resource for that community's workers. On We Do the Work, they really did the work. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on today's Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
Welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR 8:55 a.m. streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. Annie back, and hello, Jordan.
Hi, Annie. It's really good to be back in the studio. Yeah, I had a bit too long of a holiday, and moving house on top of it has just compounded everything, and I really miss the time in the studio. So
it's really nice. It is. It's great to be back, and we hope all you people out there are thinking the same.
Mm.
I've got Dave Harris on the line. G'day, Dave.
Hey,
how
Dave.
Are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you both today?
Oh, good.
Doing solid.
It's our first day back after a long break. We're as happy as Larry.
Oh, that's good. Happy New Year.
Yeah, you too. Mm. And you guys down at Southeast Melbourne Peter's Ice Cream Production are not as happy as we are in the studio this morning. You're from the United Workers Union. Do you want to give us an outline of what's actually going on?
Yeah, sure. We've been negotiating with Peter's Ice Cream in Mulgrave since February of last year. obviously they've taken a bit longer due to COVID, stage four restrictions, all that kind of stuff. But the first offer the company put out for their log of claims is to drop the casuals to $22.50, remove leave loading, medical certificate for every absence, and also removal of the flu injections.
Okay.
They then put out an EBA for voting in April, where they actually raised the lift, the casual rate of pay to $26.95, but a 0% pay increase over the 3 years. That got rejected, 147 no's to 4 yeses.
Mm.
So since April why did
four
to now,
people, how did 4 people say yes?
I don't know, and I haven't been able to find out who those 4 people are to actually understand why they voted yes.
But, devil's advocate, who knows. But please continue, yeah.
Yeah, so since April to now, so that's easily 8 months of negotiating, we've gotten up to 5% over 3 years through some very tense negotiations. But they still not budge on the $26.95 for the casuals rate of pay. So that's effectively a $5.95 an hour drop in pay. And the members, the full-time, part-time members, they just won't stand for it.
Is there still any casual loading factored into that?
The casual loading is still factored into it, yes. The $26.95 still gets 25%. They were on $31.70. But the company's arguing is, oh, other companies do it, why can't we? So they haven't at any point given me any numbers on the cost saving effects and the benefits to the company when I've asked for it. They can't even justify that would give the 5% the full-timers. And the problem is they're casuals. They've got casuals there who have worked there for 17 years.
Mm.
So if you have one to go full-time, so the casuals find it very hard to go full-time because they're just packers.
Mm.
And when I say just packers, that's a very hard job, labour-intensive. But the company don't see that as a full-time position. So these people are casuals for a long time at this place. So to cut their rate of pay by $6 an hour, it's just insulting. They're looking at how they can cut costs without actually improving anything else, and they're attacking the casuals. So the easiest thing for companies to do in this day and age is just go straight after the casuals. And this is a case in point.
Yeah, that's why they want this sort of insecure arrangement. What I can't get over is that there's all this language around this federal government and all their kind of cronies always acting like they're there for jobs. And we've just been talking about Amazon, where the guy is talking about how unions can't ensure that you get paid and they can't ensure that you've got a secure job. But, of course, your members can see it right up close that these employers that they've been working for 17 years, they can't either.
No, that's right. I mean, if you're a casual for 17 years, worst case scenario, you should be on a permanent part-time roster.
Absolutely.
You should have some kind of security in a job you've given 17 years of your life to. And that's the problem. Like, I do know the delegates at Peters who are doing an amazing job have been pushing for a lot of these casuals to be made permanent, and the company just doesn't want to hear it.
The really interesting thing about this is, of course, that there's been all this mantra about during COVID that we're all doing it together. Your members were working during COVID, and as you said, they're actually selling a lot of ice cream at the moment.
Oh, they are.
So they're not losing money.
Yeah, the share price has really jumped over that time period.
Yeah, and they haven't changed. So this idea that's been pushed around that people have to tighten their belts so that business can recover, it's a lot of crock, isn't it?
Even I've negotiated all through stage four restrictions in Melbourne, every company pulled out the same thing. Oh, sales are down. It's like, but you're working overtime every day. You're working overtime on the weekend, and it's the same as Peter's. Overtime every day, overtime on the weekend. People are buying ice cream. It might not be from their normal chain of sales, but it's gone up somewhere else. I ate a lot of ice cream during lockdown, which I'm paying for now.
Yeah. Yep, guilty as charged. Yep, for me as well.
Yeah. But yeah, there was all through stage four. Did miss a day. Went to work every single day. But production didn't slow down. Peter's Carrera sell a lot of ice cream, and people are free to make up their own minds on what they buy during this time where Peter's have been a little bit unfair to their workers. But yeah, hopefully people show the company that regardless if you work there or not, it's got to stop. It's enough is enough.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Danny. Thank you, Jordan. Appreciate your time.
can't you beg? And when you let them know you're more dead than alive in a 9-to-5, then they say you've got to go and get yourself a job or get out of this house. Get yourself a job or you a man or a mouse. A finger in each ear, you pretend not to hear. Gotta get some space, get out of this place.
Man, man, I am a man. Job or no job, you can't tell me that.
If you listen real hard, you can hear the sound of a million people switching out for work. Well, listen, Mr. Average, you're a jerk. Not me, you can't hold me down. Not me, I'm gonna fool around. Gonna have some fun, look out for number one. You can dig your grave, I'm staying young.
That was Wham Rap, Enjoy What You Do. You're listening to Your Rights at Work, Chris Garlock, Ed Smith. That was from the playlist for the brand new book just released 2 days ago, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone, written by our next guest, journalist Sarah Jaffe. Sarah is a prolific journalist. She covers the politics of power from the workplace to the streets. Welcome to Your Rights at Work.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So the reviews are already coming in. Congratulations. They're pretty much rave reviews. I noticed that your favorite headline so far is from Bitch Magazine, which says Sarah Jaffe kills the dream job. Why does this kind of sum up what you're getting at in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a journalist and I do love what I do. But I also think that there is a lot of insidious ways that loving what we do gets used to make us work harder for longer hours and for less money. And how dare we make any demands? And I actually just got off the phone with a yoga instructor who is unionizing, who, you know, it was incredibly intense in her field, right? The way that this sort of spiritual practice of doing yoga that she believed very much in and spent years of her life investing in and training and becoming an instructor, then if she has any problems with her working conditions, it's like, well, if you were practicing yoga correctly, then all good things would be coming to you, right? That it must be you, basically, rather than, you know, it turns out that this thing that had been her dream job, still doesn't treat you very well because at bottom, somebody's still trying to make a profit off of it.
You have a whole chapter on retail workers. I would love to get your take on essential workers.
I worked in restaurants for quite a few years before I was a journalist full time. So I sympathize deeply. And like, it is fascinating, right? Because we do sort of expect people to like eat good feelings, like, oh, you're essential. Isn't that great? Well, yeah, but like that still doesn't pay the rent and it right. doesn't pay the hospital bill if I come down with COVID and have to be put on a ventilator, right? The way that so many workers over and over have said, like they call us essential, but what they really mean is expendable. Mm-hmm. You know,
I think you really thought deeply about sort of the nature of work. And I'm wondering, going forward into 2021, give us a little hope here.
I think the hope is that people are more than ever interested in organizing, right? Like I said, I'm off the phone with yoga instructors who are organizing all of these fields that like we would not have thought of as being, you know, ripe for union drives are suddenly having, you know, really incredible organizing bursts because people are realizing how screwed they are. There's always, always reason to feel hopeful when people are out there organizing and raising hell. So I think the thing that is good about all of this awfulness is that it makes it really, really clear that work is not a thing we do because we love it, but because we have to. And the only way we can make it better is by fighting.
Oh, what a great ending. Sarah Jaffe, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show. It's a great book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. It's just out. Get it, read it, pass it around. And I can't wait to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I do what I love, and I love what I do. To fight you, baby, just together it's no good. And I know that I'm strong, but my mind's almost gone, and it's getting on my mood.
and all this fussing you've been doing. See, you got me hanging up. See, you really got me worse. But I gotta.
Listening to On Writing, a podcast from the Writers Guild of America East. I'm your host, Jerry Cole. In each episode, you'll hear writers working in film, television, and news break down everything from the writing process to pitching, favorite jokes to key scenes, and so much more. Today, I'm joined by Lena Waithe, creator of the new BET series, 20s. Lena is known for her award-winning writing on series such as Master of None, The Chi, and her feature film, Queen and Slim. Her latest project, 20s, centers on a young screenwriter and her girlfriends as they pursue their Hollywood dreams. I talked with Lena about never pandering to an audience, how the series A Different World influences her work, and how success can come in small doses. Hi, Lena. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I just want to start very quickly, because it's a very weird time, but just see how you're doing. How are you?
I'm holding up pretty well. And I think it's interesting because I think I always tend to be a little even keel no matter what's happening in the world. I think, I don't know if that's the writer in me or just the black person in me, where it's just weird. I don't think that black people are that taken down by adversity. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of adversity happening in the world, but mm-hmm. black folks have always been in the midst of that. So it's, the world has always been burning. I think now mm-hmm. we just have cameras on it.
Is there a certain kind of energy that you try and keep front and center?
No. Not really.
So let's talk about the development of the show, because I read that you started writing it in your 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long has that process been and how much of it changed through the years?
It's definitely been, I wrote it, because I'm not great with dates, but a great sort of tracker for me is Girls. Because I wrote it that, I started working on it the year that came out. And initially it was just going to be like a sketch. And I was going to do, because I had written this thing that had gone viral online called Shit Black Girls Say. So I was mm-hmm. going to follow it up as a spoof on Girls and call it Black Girls and kind of a version of each character. And then someone said to me, they were like, this is more than a spoof. This could actually be a show. And also, I think there was something very interesting about Lena Dunham being a young writer and coming up and us having the same name. And me, I went to an early screening of Girls. And I really remember thinking, like, we need something like this with sort of offbeat sensibilities for black women. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Young women trying to figure mm-hmm. it out. And it took a while for us to have something like that. And luckily, obviously, you have stuff like Insecure, I May Destroy You, 20s. And I love mm-hmm. that all of them can exist in the same time. It's not like one has to go off of the other to live. Although I know mm-hmm. Insecure is coming to an end, but it's always important, I think, to have black women who don't have it all figured out on screen. Because I do think it's definitely this weird idea that black women are just like the most resilient. We've got it all figured out. We know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. It is a part of the Claire Huxtable model, which we love. Mm-hmm. But I think we've had to reshape that for ourselves, because then it becomes too aspirational TV, mm-hmm. where I aspire to be perfect. And that's just mm-hmm. not honest. Or these ideas of we want to see black stuff with no trauma is definitely something that's come up a lot. But I feel like I see in the whole picture, not just the pieces mm-hmm. of it that look good to me. Mm-hmm. So to me, 20s definitely is lighter fare. It's not Queen and Slim. But at the same time, it's the same. It's like black people living their lives. Now, one is a little bit more high stakes, mm-hmm. but Hattie becoming a writer to her is life or death.
So this is also relatively autobiographical?
There's a reason why it can't be. It's because Hattie is walking into a Hollywood that didn't exist when I came to LA. Mm. Moonlight had not won Best Picture. Get Out was not a thing. Me Too hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. There were no like black lesbians that looked like Joe on TV. And so I had to really adapt to that. Like, I was like, oh, who is, because Hattie is an algorithm of me. But at the end of the day, it's like, what would I have been had I walked into Hollywood today? Mm-hmm. And it's actually more pressure, because before you could be like, it's only one at a time. We got to figure it out. Right. Now there's a million channels. There's a million streaming services. There's all these different ways. And also, too, you have social media, which, yes, it was existing when I was in my 20s, but it wasn't as rampant. It wasn't this. Mm-hmm. And also, it's different now. Twitter has shifted. Instagram has shifted. It's become more communal. It can sometimes be frustrated. It can be happy. It can rally behind certain people and go against others. So now as a Black artist, I have to reflect that for Hattie, that she does have to worry about Black Twitter. She does have to wonder, like, she can't cast a light-skinned actress. Is somebody going to be mad at her if she's cast a British Black actress in a role that's before in America? These are things now that Black artists have to worry about that I think back in the day you didn't really necessarily worry about. You just were like, okay, let's figure this thing out. And now there's actually more eggshells that she has to walk on. So that's why it can't ever be that autobiographical. And also, too, I've never had a romantic relationship with the boss. You know, I was like, that's never happened. So it is still a TV show, and we want to make it interesting. And as we continue with the seasons, she'll get further away from me and become more just a very independent, unique character. But I do, the fact that people look at it as, oh, this is Lena's origin story. But in essence, it's more, I'm more Ida B than Hattie now. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, I love writing scenes between those two characters because it's sort of me talking to my younger self in a way.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So good talking to you.
That's it for this episode. On Writing is a production of the Writers Guild of America East. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and rate us. I'm Duri Cole. Thank you for listening, and write on.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City.
The count is down, the devil's in town, he's getting us one by one. We're losing ground, we're going down, each off on our own. Sparks will fly, good people will die, it's dark before the dawn. The fire will burn till we finally learn the way they're gonna change the paradigm. On the streets and picket lines, every craft and every trade, break the chain, there's a world to gain. Man the barricades, as long as people of color are shot down in the street. Some sister or some brother chained in poverty, as long as they fill the jails with tales of hell and misery. At the very least, there'll be no peace till we finally see. Black, white, blue, and red, like the IWW said, like a rainbow in the sky. Sound the bell, it's time to rebel. People, it's do or die. The water's bad, the cows are mad, grim reapers everywhere. On the farms and city homes, breathing poison air. No place to run, no place to hide, might as well get it right. The answer for this cancer is when we all unite. This planet's all we got. Let's give it our best shot. For a better world in birth, and in every land, protecting Mother Earth.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm your host, Chris Mann. Mike Stout wrote the song we've just heard, One Big Union. Mike is not only a musician, but a relentless union and social justice activist from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mike wrote the book, Homestead Steel Mill, The Final 10 Years. This is the actual tale of Local 1397 and the fight for union democracy. Mike was a crane operator in Homestead Steelworks. He later became grievance chair for the local, even serving after he was laid off. Welcome to the show, Mike.
So why did you write this book?
I wrote this book for three reasons. Number one, the vast majority of the population in the United States, including the majority of workers, have never been in a union, don't know anything about unions, and what they have heard about unions is utter BS. And I think it was important to establish my personal history and direct history with unions inside a steel mill and why unions were necessary then and why their unions are necessary today. And not only why unions are necessary, but what unions should look like. And by that, there's always been two forms out there. There's the business style unionism, and there's what we call democracy solidarity unionism. And when I entered the Homestead Mill, the situation was it was a business union, and it was a very bad business union. They didn't even do their business. That workers had virtually no representation, paid dues for nothing, and a small group of people got together and decided to do something about it.
Tell us about the newspaper, the plant-wide newspaper, the 1397 rank and file.
The newspaper, in my opinion, was to this day the most progressive democratic expression inside a union that I've ever seen or read about. And it was started by a young woman who was only 24 years old named Michelle McMills. And back in the 1970s, she was in a man's world. She was in a macho man's steel world. And for a 24-year-old woman to go into that world and do what she accomplished, in my opinion, she was up there with Mother Jones.
That's all the time we have for tonight. There's so much that unionists can glean from this book written by Mike Stout, Homestead Steel Mill, The Final 10 Years, that we've asked Mike to return for a show in March.
And now, here's your next episode of My Labor Radio.
How you doing, folks? It's Mark, your host on My Labor Radio. Thanks for listening to this edition. We have a special guest today. We're going to talk to Brock Diedrich. He's the president of UAW Local 164 at Eaton in Auburn, Indiana. Brock is the president of a now 84-member local. It was a lot bigger in years gone by. Things have changed, and Eaton announced they are closing later in the first quarter of 2021. How old is Local 164? It's been around a few years.
Yeah, it was formed in 1942.
Yeah.
And actually, the building, it was the Auburn Clutch Company.
That's right. And thank you. Yeah.
Yes. It started in 1941, and then it was there for about a year, and then the workers decided to form the union. And then I think it was 1945-46 that Dana bought it. Up until 1997 that Eaton bought it in that year.
Things were going really well for you guys, weren't they? You guys were making a lot of profit for them.
We made last year $40 million profit from that building.
Yeah.
It's been profitable the whole time that it's been there. If you go back to 97 when Eaton bought it, they pretty much ever since that point started taking, we used to have heat treat in there, machining,
right,
everything you can think of. And they just pick pieces here and there and send it out of the country down to Mexico,
right,
where they do a lot of it. My thing through this whole thing is that Eaton, they build the clutch for the stockholder and the shareholder. They don't build it for the customer anymore. And we've seen this. I've been around that plant. My dad retired from there, Terry Dietrich, 39 years. I remember going down to Louisville to some of the conventions at the Galt House down there in Louisville when I was 10, 11 years old. I was in that building when I was 5, 6 years old. So the day that they announced it, November 6th, I think the day was, 6th or 7th, one of those 2 days. Mm-hmm. We stuck around the union officer a little bit, got a hold of our rep and talked to him. And I ended up going home because they gave us the rest of the day off with pay. They're like, we're shutting it down. Here you go. You know,
that's real big of you. Yeah.
Yeah. Ended up going over to my mom and dad's house. And my dad lives, I live in Garrett here. Mom and dad live right across town, small community. I go in over there and my dad asked me, he's, oh, you took a vacation day? And I was like, nope, they're closing it. And he's, what? Eaton's closing. And he said, he looked at me, didn't miss a beat. And he said, I'm surprised it took him this long.
Oh, yeah.
He's been there and he went through that. And I'd seen some of it too, just going from Dana to Eaton.
So in the article I read most recently, early December, probably 6th or 7th of December, we're going to still talk to the union and see how things are going to go. That's where the final decision is. Was that just a smokescreen of some kind? They'd already made up their mind when they came to you in November, didn't they?
We got called in. It was like 6:30 in the morning. Hey, we got an emergency meeting. Obviously, we had COVID stuff going on too. That's what we thought it was about. And that's the thing too. We're essential workers. And you know, we got to be in there doing our work. We went pretty much the whole summer and pretty much most of the fall without any cases at all. That's a testament to the employees doing the right thing. We finally got one or two, I think it was. And then that's what we thought the meeting was about. And then we went in there. The vice president of Vehicle Group North America, James Owens, pretty much laid it out there for us. And it was a surreal moment, but I think we all had that in the back of our minds. I've only been there 6.5 years, and that I've heard that ever since the day I hired in that they were going to close that plant. Right after that, at 7 o'clock when the shift started, they had everybody come outside and They had a speakerphone, kept us 6 feet apart and told us, hey, we're closing the plant. And we had talked to them when we had that meeting at 6:30, though. We'd said, hey, what can we do? And they're like, it's either 50% of the hourly people or 50% pay cut. Come on. Really?
Not even. Yeah.
There was over 500 people working in that plant.
I can remember now, those numbers. Yeah.
Now we're down to 84. Picking things where they can make them cheaper. And obviously we know them moving down to North Carolina. We're looking at the people down there doing the same job that we're doing for $6-7 less an hour. They're not union. Mm-hmm. And they don't want any union influence down there. So They asked them if they wanted to relocate down there. Most of them don't want to go down there. They don't want to move to North Carolina.
They have family here. Everything's rooted here. They have no reason to leave.
When this got announced, we had 84 employees. We still have 84 employees. We have not had one person walk out the door. We have not had one person quit. And that's just, it's a testament to our employees. And they're good, hardworking people that want to make, you know, ends meet and make a living.
And make a good product for their company because they know it's going to keep them in business.
Yes. I get a little, you know, worked up a little bit at work when I'm sitting there and I hear somebody calling for quality to come out and check a part after all this has happened. You're losing your job, but you're still putting forth that effort. I absolutely love this job because I could get told something and I didn't agree with it. And I could say why I couldn't agree with it. At other jobs, I was in the Army for 4 years. I went to Afghanistan, all that stuff. When somebody told me to do something there, I couldn't say no. I couldn't say maybe this way is better or maybe this way is safer. I couldn't say that. Having that background and having that voice, learning to have that voice, it's been a great part of my life. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Remember, take care of each other at work. The boss won't do it.
My brother, 'cause if you do, you can hear their voices still calling from across the years. And they're crying across the ocean, they're crying across the land, and they will until we all come to understand.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Network's Wednesday weekly live stream Labor Talk with labor leaders discussing current labor issues. My name is Evan Papp and I'm with Empathy Media Lab and I focus on labor, political economy, art and culture. And my co-host this week is Bama Threa. Bama.
Hi, great to be with everyone this week. I'm Bama Threa. I host the Gig Podcast, which is about gig worker organizing worldwide. I am so delighted to be hosting this show tonight with some absolutely wonderful guests. So Neha, can we start with you?
I am Neha Mishra, and I am the Senior Specialist for Migration at the Solidarity Center. We're an international labor rights NGO that's an allied organization of the AFL-CIO.
Great. Shannon, let's turn to you.
Good evening, brothers, sisters, siblings, Julie working for the AFL-CIO, doing the immigration policy work, which means that I get the privilege of working with our affiliates from all sectors, with our labor councils from all of our states and cities, and also with our International Trade Union Confederation and our global unions.
I'm JJ Rosenbaum with the newly merged Global Labor Justice and International Labor Rights Forum.
Fantastic. So we are coming out of one of the worst administrations we could even imagine on pretty much anything international, but certainly on these issues, migration, immigration, and labor. And we're starting a new administration. And it's exciting and hopeful in a way. And I think it's a good moment for us to say, okay, what do we really think the right policies are? What does progressive policy look like? We're talking about people who are migrating for work. Right? They're not necessarily immigrants. They're migrants. They leave their countries for work. They're often called guest workers, although they're not often treated like guests. And they may want to go home again. And so to start with JJ or Shannon, tell us what the legal context is for migrant workers in the U.S. today. What are the restrictions on them and how does that work?
we need to emphasize a shift away from immigration enforcement and towards labor standards enforcement. Right now, we spend 12 times more as a country to enforce our immigration laws than we do to enforce the labor laws meant to protect 160 million workers and in work sites all around the country.
JJ, I would love for you to jump in because I know you've worked directly with migrant workers. What are things like in the legal context we have today, and what does it look like for them?
I think Shannon's point is really important because we have broken, or some would say rigged, immigration system that works really well for employers. A recent report by Forward US estimates that 5 million undocumented people are working as essential workers right now. 1 million of those are dreamers. And so I think we have to really have a holistic approach to getting people on a path to permanency, on a path to full labor rights.
Yeah, Neha, so if you could talk a little bit about what the context is like for migrant workers in other countries.
Sure, Mama. And I think what this horribleness of COVID has shown a spotlight that we have evidence now, we have stories, we have data we can put before policymakers and say, you can't hide anymore. Everything that we've been saying to you for 10 years, 20 years, Jay Shannon, Bama, yourself, like to governments, that these temporary migration programs are exploitative. They are structurally flawed, and here's why. So when we've said to governments that by not allowing workers freedom of association in other countries when they migrate is a problem, we saw that in COVID, that when workers either got laid off, they weren't given their severance pay, there was huge wage theft. Like, wage theft has always been a problem for migrant workers, but it has been exponentially a bigger problem under COVID because employers were so desperate as the economies were crashing, they just fired workers and didn't pay them what they were owed. We've been saying that for years, there has to be protections against that. And freedom of association with unions would have allowed unions to negotiate with employers for protection. Occupational safety and health protections. Like, we've been saying forever that workers should be able to have a say in the safety of their own workplaces. And we've shown in these formal, regular, not just not undocumented, but workers that come through legal with a visa anywhere around the world, that they were have been denied proper occupational safety and health equipment, personal protection equipment. And the biggest thing is these programs and the way global migration is structured as a practice around the world, it excludes migrant workers from social safety net protections, excludes them from healthcare and medical care, from access to income stabilization. I am very confident that the new administration is going to come back in to the Global Compact for Migration process. And because of appointments of people like Julie Hsu, that hopefully we can push them to have a more progressive agenda and voice in these multilateral institutions where there are still a lot of other authoritarian governments who have a loud voice within the UN system, that hopefully the US can play a leading role again as a progressive voice, even different from the Obama years.
You better listen, my brother, because if you do, you can hear their voices still calling from across the years. And they're crying across the ocean, they're crying across the land, and they will until we all come to understand. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free if one of us is chained. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free if one of us is chained. None of us are free. There are people in darkness.
We dig the ditch. We teach the kids. We lend a hand. We do the work.
Welcome to We Do the Work, the voice of workers everywhere seeking economic and social justice for themselves and for their families. We pull no punches. We call out the lies of those waging unrelenting war on working families. We Do the Work is produced and engineered by Janet McKinney and co-hosted by Mike Dumovich, Gary Cantor, Lori Province, and Ken Winkus. This is your show.
In our show today, Gary interviews Anne Feeney, an amazing and passionate singer and songwriter, about her life as an agitator, activist, mom, and much more.
And then we say farewell
with Ken Giving, We Do the Works, Goodbye. And I would like to add that producing this show and advocating for the working class, unions, and social and economic justice has been an honor.
We are talking today with Ann Feeney, union maid, hellraiser, cancer survivor, mother, and I understand a former attorney. So one of the things I just recently learned was that you were a trial attorney.
Last time I practiced law was when I was president of the Musicians Union in Pittsburgh, and it was my great pleasure. I told people if they got stiffed on a gig to call me, and they did, and I took every single one of those bars to court and settled with them all. They all got paid.
Oh, that's great.
And it was great.
Terrific. We're members of the same union then.
That's right. Yes.
And you're also a Wobbly.
I am.
And how long have you been with the Wobblies?
I was a Wobbly when John Lennon was killed.
Oh, okay.
I was a Wobbly. I think of different seminal events in my life where I could actually remember whether or not I was a Wob. I don't know, but it's been my pleasure. We had a bar in Pittsburgh called Wobbly Joe's, but at that point, that was in the 70s, I didn't know that the Wobs were still around. I had songbooks, but I didn't quite get it. The book looked so old that when it said I could write to Chicago for more information, I assumed that address was no longer valid, and actually it wasn't. The headquarters had moved to San Francisco by then.
Right. So it sounds like your musical background was shaped like a lot of us in the 60s, what Arlo Guthrie referred to as the folk scare of the 60s.
Right. I think Tom Paxton owns that phrase, though.
Oh, okay. I interviewed Arlo, and he used it, so he was probably borrowing it.
Just like his dad.
Exactly. Only his dad called it research.
Right.
So when did you kind of realize that you were a union maid, a labor troubadour?
Oh, very early on. My grandfather was an organizer for the United Mine Workers during the 20s and 30s, actually the turn of the century through the 30s. He died in 1939. I never met him.
And he was a musician, too.
He was. He played the violin, and I knew that he played the violin, but I didn't know he used it to organize workers until I started researching his life. I'm writing a book about him.
Oh, great.
But my dad would tell me as a child, well, your grandfather was a great union man, and everybody in Pittsburgh's dad was a great union man, pretty much.
Well, Pittsburgh is a great union town.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But my dad would put me to bed at night with tales of the coal and iron police and going along with his dad into they were company towns. He'd have to slip under barbed wire fence that had machine gun turrets at the perimeter to keep union people out. And he would be usually in the basement of one of the houses and near the root cellar. And there'd be people jammed in and lined up against the walls to try to hear what he had to say. And he wouldn't start until he was assured by the people who had invited him that there were no stool pigeons or spies in the room, because it would mean the jobs and sometimes the lives of the miners who had invited him there.
Right.
If he started. So he would play Croatian and Serbian and Hungarian and Estonian and Latvian tunes on his violin. And if somebody came in that was suspicious, they'd say, "You know, nothing going on here. It's a music concert. Go away." And they'd leave. And eventually he'd get time to talk union. And from the time my dad was old enough to go with him, my dad would go around the room then and pass out the cards and get their signatures and watch them make their mark.
So what'd your dad do?
My dad ended up putting himself through college during the Depression. He graduated from Duquesne in 1931 with a degree in chemistry, and he worked for a small family-owned chemical firm in Carnegie, during World War II, making a lot of war supplies, magnesium flares primarily, and the laboratory he worked in exploded and killed the guy who hit the light switch. And my father's only memory of that explosion was trying to put the fire out on this guy using shingles from the roof. He couldn't figure out what it was that was cutting through his hands.
Oh, wow.
But it was roof shingles from the building that had exploded. So he said, if I'm going to die, I'll die on the front. And he enlisted in the Army. I'm trying to remember. Let's see, he was born in 1910, so he was definitely one of the oldest guys in his unit.
Yeah,
they called him Pops.
Okay, so you come from a union background then.
I didn't realize how strong my union background was until I started doing this research on my grandfather, but he was one of the main organizers of the 1919 steel strike in Pittsburgh. I have a picture of him and Mother Jones getting ready to speak at a rally during that strike.
Oh, man, that's incredible.
Yeah. When Eugene Debs came to Pittsburgh, it was my grandfather who introduced him at the Coyle Theater.
Oh, so what you're saying is you come from royalty now.
Well, there's no royalty in the labor movement. You know that.
I know. Yes, I was being ironical.
Yes.
So at what point do you think, or was there a specific point where you said, okay, you know, I've sung about the war, I've sung about human rights and civil rights, I am going to identify myself as a labor advocate? Was there kind of like a seminal moment where that happened?
Oh, I still sing all sorts of songs. I still sing for peace and feminism and the environment. But Utah Phillips and I were on the phone one day with this reporter, and three or four times Phillips said, you know, Ann Feeney is the best labor singer in North America.
Right.
And I said, Bruce, if you say that again, he's going to write it down. He said, that's exactly why I'm saying. He said, I don't have anything to give you except my reputation. That's if my 2 cents worth are worth anything. That's how I feel. Well, that is a lovely gift, and you're the only person in the country I'd allow to say that, since you are the best labor singer in North America.
Oh, man, that is quite a compliment.
Right.
Oh, that's really great. So when you went in that direction, you started lining up union events and labor rallies and things like that, and that became kind of your thing?
Honestly, as a young folk singer, I was kind of turned off by labor because I had met Jacques Jablonski, and I was very excited to meet somebody from the mine workers who remembered my grandfather, and we were going to meet at the beginning of 1970, and that New Year's Eve, he and his family were murdered. And it turned out the murder was ordered by the president of the mine workers, Tony Boyle.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't think too much of the mine workers at that point. And we were trying to desegregate the building trades, and they hated us.
Right.
And when we would be at anti-war demonstrations, the carpenters and the people would be lined up on each side of us, throwing things at us and telling us to go to Russia.
The infamous hard hats.
Right. So my reconciliation with labor really came when during the J.P. Stevens boycott in the early 80s, and Cy Conn came to town, and I listened to him. I was very inspired by him, and not long after that, Charlie King came to town, and he just blew me away.
When you say came to town, where were they? Which town?
Pittsburgh.
Oh, they were in Pittsburgh. Okay.
Yes. And I gave Charlie a cassette that I had just finished, and he handed me one of his recordings right off the sales table. And you know, mine was just made in my living room. And I said, oh, I'm not worthy. And he said, well, of course you are. You know, I mean, he was just very sweet and thanked me for the good work I did. And I was trying to think of what good work I had done. And I began to get a lot more active. The janitors were locked out that winter in Pittsburgh, and I sang on their picket lines. Two people died during that strike. It was so bitter cold, and the Building Owners Association got an injunction to stop them from having burn barrels outside the buildings to keep from freezing to death while they were picketing. And two people died from the stress. It was just horrible. Heart attacks.
Oh, wow.
So people always talk about unions as though there's some greedy big power mongers. And Billy Bragg's right. It's a comfort to the widow and a light to the child. Unions do so many good things in this society. And anybody who has a vacation or a day off or doesn't have to go to work when they're sick can thank the labor movement for that.
Absolutely.
I've been enamored of the labor movement a while.
Right. Well, it sounds like a lot of us who got their early training back in the same era, because you and I are about the same age. To my generation, labor was pretty much a settled deal. And again, the ones, like you were saying, the personal contact we were having were the hard hats.
And they endorsed Nixon.
Yeah, and they were all pro-war. And it was only over the last several years that labor was starting to really get vilified. And they started coming after the unions, and coming after the unions means coming after everybody, all working people. And so it's become the front line of the war against the haves, and as it always was and always should be.
Right. One of the things that I got excited about from our conversation was you were asking me to pick three songs that I was very fond of. And the three songs that I'm particularly fond of don't get much airplay. And the reason that I love them so much is they are fantastic recordings.
Oh, okay.
And to me, making a record is different than being on stage. it's wildly different. I'm not trying to sound exactly like I sound on stage, because in the first place, I couldn't without an audience there.
Exactly.
And in the second place, it's really hard to get a good live album.
Yes.
But when I write these songs, I'm hearing a whole lot more than the audience is when I'm performing one of my songs.
Right.
Or one of the songs that I love. And I got everything that I wanted out of those three songs. And I'm going to talk about them since you set me up to do this, and well, I hope you get a chance to play them.
Oh, we are going to play them, yes.
Shell Game is a song I wrote right in the middle of Oil War I.
Oh, okay.
And I was so angry. Everybody was wearing those yellow ribbons, and Whitney Houston sang the Star Spangled Banner. I don't know if you remember that, but
yes.
Everybody was playing her version of that, and
yeah.
It was on the radio all the time. And I was so angry that I wrote what I realized. I mean, when I perform it, I hear the metal song that I wrote. But,
uh-huh.
Of course, without a band, it's not really a metal song. But I got exactly what I wanted in that recording. I said to the drummer, I want you to be as furious. There's a moment where the drums really take over. I said, yeah, I want you to be as furious as I am at the waste and the suffering in this war.
Uh-huh.
And he really let him have it. It was great. It was superb. Uh-huh.
Was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger? Was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger? When you saw naked aggression, did you forget about recession? When you watched him kick some ass, did you forget the underclass? Who could spare a moment for the homeless or the poor? Who cares about the deficit? We won a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger? If you spoke of education, did you lose your concentration? If you thought of unemployment, did it spoil the game's enjoyment? As the burning oil wells lit the sky, we hailed the new world order. Don't think of all those Kurdish children starved along the border, caught in the shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger. Must we all avert our eyes and walk in lockstep with this man? What about the 100,000 that we buried in the sand? Let Whitney sing the song out, yellow ribbons sea to sea. How could Iraq make reparations? Will there be future confrontations? Have we brought peace to all these nations? Or just restored some monarchy?
So that's one of the songs I sent you. The other one was Kim and Reggie Harris. And I mean, I have so many songs that I really like, but
mm-hmm.
these three are superb. Kim and Reggie Harris and John Fromer and Janet Stecker and Susan Lewis and I doing an a cappella rendition of a song that the Kensington Welfare Rights Union
uh-huh.
adapted during their March for Human Rights. It was in the aftermath of Clinton's cruel dissolving of the welfare, ending
mm-hmm.
welfare as we know it. And they went on a bus across the country interviewing women to see how their lives had been impacted by these draconian cuts to the public assistance. And we presented them all at the United Nations on my birthday. Remember, I was in Doug Hammarskjöld Plaza singing this song with them. And this recording with Kim and Reggie is just fantastic. And John, everybody really put out for that recording. That's the rich man's house.
Right.
Well, I went down to the rich man's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took it back, took back my dignity, took back my humanity. Oh, I
Went down to the rich man's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took it back, took back my dignity. Took back my humanity. Now he's under my feet, under my feet, under my feet, under my feet. Ain't gonna let the system walk all over me. Well, I went down to the landlord's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took back my dignity. Took back my humanity. Oh, I went down to the landlord's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took back my dignity. Took back my humanity. Now he's under my feet, under my feet, under my feet, under my feet. They're gonna let the system walk all over me. Well, I went down to the welfare office. I took back what they stole from me. Took it back, took back my dignity. Took it back, took back my humanity. Oh, I went down to the welfare office. I took back what they stole from me. Took it back, took back my dignity. Took it back, took back my humanity. Now they're under my feet, under my feet, under my feet, under my feet. They're gonna let the system walk all over me. Well, I went down to the governor's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took it back,
took back my dignity.
Took it back,
took back my humanity.
Oh, I went down to the governor's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took it back,
took back my dignity.
Took it back,
took back my humanity.
Now he's under my feet.
So I want to talk about your cancer, and it's still in remission, right?
Well, remission isn't a good word for what I'm in, because the kind of cancer I have is really kind of an automatic death sentence. Mm-hmm. And they told me when they diagnosed me on August 10th of 2010 that I might not even make it to Christmas.
Right.
And to get my affairs in order. It's going to come back. They know this. They know it's going to come back, but they don't know when. And what I have is small cell lung cancer with metastatic tumors in my brain. And they've all responded to treatment, but there's still a lesion in the back of my head that they're treating and stuff. So, you know, this is going to take me. But I say, hey, we're all going to die. I still don't know when. What's the difference? So I'm lucky that I feel so good. And my docs all look at me. They can't believe I'm still alive. Are you all right? And nothing hurts? You feel okay? They're just incredulous that I could possibly be feeling and looking as good as I do.
Yeah, well, you know, I was really surprised when I saw you up in Bellingham at that concert, how dynamic and animated and everything you were, realizing that what you had come through, and everybody there was just really thrilled that you were so healthy and so so good. It was a wonderful show, and that was the first time I ever saw you live, too.
Oh, really?
Yes. Third song was School Days End.
It was a hard pick. That's a Ewan McCall piece. I don't know if you know it. It's about child labor.
Yes.
And the guy who plays Dobro on that is just fantastic. In fact, all of the songs I was considering for my third favorite, his work on Do Re Mi is unbelievable. His work on School Days Over is fantastic. I like School Days Over because I was really young when I did that, and I can hear my young voice in the song. I was happy with the performance that I did, and a friend of mine who had never touched a mandolin in his life saw the mandolin in the studio, and he says, you need some mandolin on this, and he went in and did his first performance on a mandolin on my album, and it's great.
Isn't that great when you bring that out in other people?
Well, it is.
School
days over. Come on then, John. Time to be getting your pit boots on. On with your sark and moleskin trousers. It's time you were on your way. Time you were learning the pitman's job and earning a pitman's pay. Come on then, Jim. It's time to go. Time you were working down below. Time to be handling a pick and shovel. You start at the pit today. Time you were learning the collier's job and earning a collier's pay. Come on then, die. It's almost light. Time you were off to the anthracite. The morning mist is on the valley. It's time you were on your way. Time you were learning a miner's job and earning a miner's pay. The morning mist is on the valley. It's time you were on your way. Time you were learning the miner's job and earning a miner's pay. School day's over.
Making a recording, so different from performing, organizing the public part of my life. But in the studio, I am so happy. I love it. It's so nurturing to my creative side. And I've never been obsessive in the studio. I think when you're in the studio, you're trying to record magic, not music.
Exactly.
You want to have a great dynamic going with the musicians, and I've never thought anybody got anything worthwhile on the third take.
Yeah. I lived in Nashville, and there was kind of a rule of thumb there that you get it right the first time, because after that, it's like transferring from tape to tape to tape. You lose something with each generation, whether it's the energy or just the whatever it is. But anyway, we're running out of time, so I'd just like to very quickly ask you, and I alluded to this earlier, what do you think your legacy is? How do you want to be remembered?
Well, I think you're really lucky if you get one song out that people will sing when you're gone. I'm very lucky. I mean, people have always sung my songs, but I've heard Have You Been to Jail for Justice sung in Copenhagen by young kids being evicted from the youth house. I've heard it sung by a bunch of people, including Daniel Ellsberg, who were arrested in front of the White House over the Keystone Pipeline.
Right.
The song has really gotten legs, and it's doing what I want it to do. I didn't write this song for radio or to get famous. I wrote it so that people would have something to inspire them when they were getting arrested and going to jail, and it actually doing what I dreamed for it.
That's wonderful. Well, you certainly have a legacy to be proud of, and we are proud of you. And we're looking forward to seeing you again in the great Pacific Northwest when you get here. And keep on keeping on, Ann Feeney. And thank you for being on We Do the Work.
Thank you.
And you have a great day.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
It's time to say goodbye. It is not a decision that we here at We Do the Work have made lightly. From our beginnings, over 8 years ago, We Do the Work has been a labor of love. We created the program because we believe in the power of work itself and in the fundamental goodness of the workers who do it every day at every level of society. We Do the Work promoted and celebrated workers because you, the workers, are society's foundation, and no one more deserves to be treated justly and respectfully. We have not changed our minds. We're just passing the torch to others to promote workers' rights, free and fair elections, universal health care, and to those who will fight tooth and nail the racism, the corruption, and the outsized influence of money in our politics, all things which tear us apart, weaken us, and render many workers, even in 2021, virtual slaves. We close with this, a sincere thank you to all. To our originating station, KSVR, at Mount Vernon, Washington's Skagit Valley College, and the many other stations across the country who have helped us spread the word. To all the wonderful people, the hundreds of labor leaders, writers, artists, and workers themselves who have talked with us, told their stories, shared their ideas, and sang their songs. They improved our lives immensely along the way. We hope We Do the Work has improved yours too. Thanks to We Do the Work's voices, to Gary, Lori, Mike, and especially to Janet, who really did do all of the work. Sadly, and for the last time, this is Ken Winkes for We Do the Work. And please remember, it is never over. There is always more work to do. So get to it.
Thank you for listening to We Do the Work. We Do the Work is a KSVR studio presentation made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Our thanks to the late John Fromer, original composer, and Ann Feeney for our theme song, We Do the Work, from her CD, Union Made. And remember, educate, agitate, mobilize, and organize.
That's it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 labor radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon and Evan Papp, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net and find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Also, check out our weekly live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network's YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. See you next time.